You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
I even met an 11-year-old boy, Eritrean, a couple of weeks ago in Lampedusa. This is something that these children have seen anything in their lives. They're just 11 or 12 or 8. This is just unbelievable.
As Malta holds a memorial for the estimated 800 victims of the migrant boat disaster in the Mediterranean, EU leaders met today to vote in favour of reinstating rescue boat missions. But is there now enough momentum to see a joint solution to the escalating crisis? Joining me for their insights today are Sebastian Borga and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Also ahead, Argentina's president is in Moscow today, and she's wasted no time cozying up to Vladimir Putin as she makes her case for Argentine economics clear.
Argentina is a country to invest in the oil industry, in the mineral industry, and the food industry.
So what's the rest of the world to make of this blossoming diplomatic friendship? Plus, Germany's continued unease over an Armenian genocide 100 years ago, and Ukraine takes a clear step closer to Europe as it prepares its World War II commemoration. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, Sebastian Borga, and a senior lecturer in law at the University of London, Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Oscar and Sebastian, welcome to you both.
Hello.
It's estimated that about 800 lives were lost during the migrant disaster in the Mediterranean at the weekend, but during a memorial service held in Malta today, just 24 coffins were carried. The fraction of those recovered became painfully clear. Meanwhile, EU leaders held an emergency meeting to discuss the crisis and reverse a vote which saw an end to rescue missions for boats carrying migrants. Sebastian Borga, the European Union, you know, had been able to basically get away for some time without having a search and rescue operation. There'd been some outcry, but it's taken this horrendous tragedy for EU leaders to realise something had to change. Do you think enough has changed, though?
We left the Italians to it, didn't we? They had started it, and we in a very lackluster way supported them for a while and then cut it off. It's not a pretty sight, no. Is it enough? Well... No, of course it isn't enough. You know, I think the engagement, the willingness of European nations, and interestingly, the further north you go, the less interested are they in engaging with problems on Europe's doorstep towards the south and east, Syria, Libya, Sudan, Somalia, etc., where a lot of these refugees are coming from.
And Oscar, there does seem to be some confusion as to whether European leaders are talking about more border patrols or more search and rescue operations, because the original Italian programme, Mare Nostrum, was a search and rescue operation. The Triton programme, as part of Frontex, the EU operation, is about border patrol. Simple as that. And, you know, if there are some people to save near Lampedusa, near the coast, fine. But we're still not getting real clarity on whether there's going to be a proper full search and rescue operation across the Mediterranean.
And the problem is that neither of those two will work in the end. At the height of Mare Nostrum operation, more than 3,000 people were found dead at sea. And as you pointed out, Frontex is a migration deterrence agency, and Triton has been created with a mandate to protect borders, not to save lives. What we need in immediate terms, not in utopian terms, in immediate terms, is legal access and the creation of a humanitarian corridor between Libya and Europe. We need ferries, we need legal access now. Otherwise, whatever we do, even increasing the militarization and surveillance, as it has happened in Gibraltar, in the Canary Islands and elsewhere, would only mean what these have already meant, more people dead at sea.
Sebastian, there's been a relatively shocking lack of leadership from Europe's elected politicians. And now they would say, well, look, there's only so far we can go. Look at the anti-immigrant mood that there is across Europe, particularly in Northern Europe. We simply can't be as liberal or as compassionate as some people would like us to be. I wonder, Sebastian, are we as a people, the people of Europe, are we as heartless as our leaders suggest we are?
Yes.
Really?
I've been rushing around the UK election campaign. Is anybody talking about foreign policy? Is anybody talking about taking hundreds, thousands of refugees? No. But Mr. Farage wants to take a few Christians.
But that's the problem. Nobody's talking about this because we have allowed people like Nigel Farage to kidnap this issue. I don't think the people of the United Kingdom is as heartless as Mr. Farage and his.
Well, look, I've been to hustings. I'm listening to the TV debates. Is anybody bringing up those issues? I haven't heard it. People talk about health. People talk about education. People talk about the roads in front of their houses. It's not, you can't just blame the politicians. I do blame the politicians, yes. And I think people like Angela Merkel should really show much more leadership on that issue, as should
Certainly.
David Cameron. But you have to say, in a democracy, politicians have to pick up the mood that people are in. And people are in a very defensive mood where they don't want to engage with what looks, admittedly, like a pretty intractable problem.
Oscar, let's not necessarily paint the olden days as being somehow glorious. It's, you know, people have always been wary of foreigners, outsiders, particularly poor people from poorer countries coming to their shores, haven't they?
Absolutely. But that doesn't mean that we must accept that as a given. We have progressed a lot from those days, which were not golden, quite the opposite. And if that is the case, then we can do so once more. I don't believe that the European people are heartless. I think they feel wary now, because of the economic crisis, because of the fact that their political leaders have not shown enough leadership, and instead tackling the economic crisis up front, they just kick the bucket and blame the proverbial scapegoat. We must, even if the people are wary, our function, particular function as media contributors, is to allow for the debate to become clearer, to become better. If it is the case that people feel wary about these things, we must tell them that it would be wrong, completely wrong, to keep allowing more people to die at sea.
Sebastian, is part of the issue here that this isn't a group of migrants coming from one country where there has been a war, or, you know, one country where there is a brutal dictatorship, or one country where there's been a horrendous natural disaster? This is people coming from Eritrea, from Syria, from Gambia, from, you know, a dozen different
Nigeria.
Countries across
yeah.
Africa. Yeah. And so, you know, in that sense, can you see then how some people in Europe think, well, look, how do we even begin to solve this crisis when there are so many different crises across Africa and the Middle East that need to be solved to prevent people wanting to flee?
Yes. Look, I mean, I'm being polemical calling Europeans heartless. I think what they are is they are puzzled and confused, and they don't know what to do. I mean, some people here in Britain now blame David Cameron for the situation in Libya, because Britain and France, supported by the US, did airstrikes and helped depose Gaddafi in 2011. And look at the country now, it's certainly a complete mess. Then the West did not intervene in Syria, and the mess. The mess is the same or even worse. So, you know, yes, I think And of course, the problem that the puzzlement and the defensiveness and the kind of the feeling that we really don't want to know too much about it is shared between the peoples of Europe and their leaders, I'm afraid.
But that's why I'm interested, Oscar, to whether actually the fact that this past week has seen this, and, you know, we've seen disasters where 300 people have died or 400 people have died, and strangely, it hasn't made much impact. It hasn't even been the top news story, and it sort of, it sort of brushed us past, and then we've moved on to something else. But I do wonder whether with this particular disaster, which seems to have really actually caught everyone's attention, it's quite hard to look at these coffins of children, you know, and to talk about the number of children that have died here and go, well, it's not our problem.
You're absolutely right, which is why this is the moment, this is the opportunity that should be used by political leaders in Europe. We must, now that the mood is changing, that people are realizing that this is morally, ethically, and politically unacceptable, this is the moment that should be seized, and we must understand that the only immediate solution is ferries and legal access.
Morally unacceptable, perhaps, and maybe everyone in this room might be able to agree, but politically unacceptable. I mean, Sebastian, it's
sadly
it's politically acceptable.
I'm sorry, I don't see it. You know, ferries, what does that mean? You invite ever more people to come across?
Absolutely. What it means is exactly what we had during the Libyan war between Misrata and some of the other ports. Ferries were actually carrying the people who needed to be carried out of those places in a much more dangerous situation.
On that point, to raise Sebastian's concern that some people in Europe would have is, well, how many people? You know, 20,000 people, 200,000 people,
many,
2 million,
as many
20
as
million?
Needed. Yes, as many as needed. That's the look. The point is this. I'm not being irrealistic
yes,
here.
You are.
Not at all. The problem is that people are already crossing, and they will continue to do so. The more you militarize those borders, the more dangerous roads they will find. So this is not about freedom of movement being a utopia, but what is being enacted on a daily basis by poor people at the cost of their lives.
Sebastian, we on yesterday's Midori House, we talked about this issue, and then we also talked about how there'd been this strange absence of any discussion about the political talks on Libya, which are currently taking place in Morocco, or sort of discussions about those talks. In the German press, has there been any real discussion about solving the Libyan political crisis, which is such a key part of this, isn't it?
But that's what I mean. You know, the Germans just say, "Oh, look at that." The French and the Brits did it. They let them sort it out. We abstained on the vote in the Security Council, which was a cowardly thing to do, I thought. Anyway, but that's what I mean. You know, we then in Berlin they say, "Well, look, we've got the Ukraine." Ukraine fish to fry. We've got to stick. We got to keep our attention on that. We can't constantly being diverted by other conflicts.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to turn now to the issue of the genocide in Armenia, which is the commemoration of it, the 100 years commemoration. It takes place later this month. And Sebastian, there is this issue of, I've just called it a genocide there, but lots of people don't, do they? What's the situation like in Germany?
Well, lots of people in Turkey.
Turkey obviously don't, no.
But name me anybody else who doesn't call it a genocide.
Well, that's partly what I'm asking you.
Scholars, I think, there's a quite overwhelming consensus.
Absolutely, yes.
To call it a genocide. You know, now let's by all means put it in the context of the First World War, difficult situation, Turkey being attacked from the Western Allies, and all that. But you can't seriously deny it.
Well, no, exactly. But then this is it, that parliamentarians in Berlin are going to be debating a motion.
Yeah.
On this genocide, but it's a rather convoluted statement, isn't it? It's they're working their way around how best to say this and that and not really offend anyone.
Yes, Well, that's realpolitik for you.
But so you say, oh, well, who doesn't think it's a genocide? Well, you know,
well, look,
German politicians.
Am I a parliamentarian?
No. Sebastian, my point is,
shouldn't we stop calling that realpolitik? It's completely unreal.
But this issue, though, you know, you say, yes, you know, anyone can look at this and go, it is what it is. And yet there is in Germany this discussion going on about how do we mark this event and what language do we use?
Well, look, I mean, I think that's... The language is convoluted because we have 3 million Turkish citizens or Turkish citizens or Germans of Turkish origin living in Germany. So we take their sensibility seriously, just as I guess the French would take the sensibilities of citizens of Moroccan and Algerian origin seriously, or the Brits tend to.
I think most Algerians would be a little unsure about whether.
Okay,
that.
Fine.
Oscar, on this issue of language, when we're talking about events 100 years ago, how you know, as a historian, how important is it that we get language right to describe things that happened 100 years ago?
It's very important because, in fact, this issue hinges precisely on history. 100 years ago, Berlin was a close ally of the Ottoman Empire and is accused by some of turning a blind eye to the massacre. That may be the reason why these parliamentarians are using such a convoluted language. But if that is the case, and it isn't the case that Chancellor Angela Merkel needs the votes of people of Turkish ascendants who might be upset by this, they should call a spade a spade. It is a genocide. Most historians agree that it is a genocide, and it is a genocide.
We're going to leave it just there. We'll be back in a moment talking about various other bits and bobs. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Stay tuned.
There's a brand new show on Monocle 24, The Big Interview, our bold new series featuring in-depth interviews with inspirational names in global politics, business, culture and design. Hosted by our senior editors, it brings you unique one-on-one discussions with fascinating characters as we find out what makes them tick. So tune in every Sunday at 9 a.m. London time to hear Monocle's insights into some of the sharpest minds shaping our world today. Starting this weekend, that's The Big Interview right here on Monocle 24.
Top ingredients, world-class service, less foam and pretension, and honest food made with dedication. Monocle focuses on what we think really matters and launches the Monocle Restaurant Awards. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 to hear of the places we value highly, where we want to dine again and again, and where most restaurant ranking lists may not guide you to.
What does it look like? What is the vitality of this place on the street? And yes, the food has to be outstanding as well, but there are many other elements that go beyond that.
The nominees will be announced every Friday on our food and drink program, The Menu, and the winner will be announced in July. Don't miss out. Tune into The Menu every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in the studio, Sebastian Borger and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. And now most of us know it as the Second World War. In Russia, however, it's commonly referred to as the Great Patriotic War. And that was the case in Ukraine too, until now. The country has decided to abolish the name in favour of the common European terminology. And in keeping with its subtle or less than subtle step towards Europe, Ukraine has chosen the poppy to symbolise its upcoming official commemoration for the Second World War. Sebastian Borger, what do we make of this?
But I have to say I find it quite obvious and nothing to write home about to call it the Second World War. I wonder about the poppy, because the poppy, the Ukrainian Prime Minister described it as a European symbol. I have to say, I've never seen it on a German or a French or a Dutch or whoever politician. It's a British or in fact maybe even very focused an English symbol of
British, not just English.
Yeah, do the Scots use it much? Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah, good.
Not
a British symbol.
English,
which is
Welsh,
fine.
Irish,
which is,
and Scots. We all fought together.
Which is fine, but. The combination seems to me a little bit desperate.
Oscar, when Mikhail Saakashvili became president of Georgia, he didn't just play the Georgian national anthem at his inauguration, but as everyone was still standing, he then played Ode to Joy, the European Union national anthem. Well, not national anthem, but you know what I mean, anthem.
Yes, the closest.
Yes, yeah. As a sort of, it was almost as if Georgia were in the EU already. And you get a similar sense from some of Ukraine's leaders now that they are so keen to tie themselves to Europe that they are using symbols, language that perhaps, the people in the country aren't necessarily sort of completely on board with yet.
We're living the era of ideological prosopopeia. They might as well lose their own flag and get the European one or the Union Jack. As it was said before. The idea here is to make it look symbolically as European as it is. But of course, as we all know, there is a distance between symbol and substance. And what is lacking here is substance.
I mean, there is a serious issue here, Sebastian, isn't there? In that, Russia has been talking up, how it sees it as its fight against fascism during the Second World War, and talking up the, how they call it, the neo-fascists that are now running Ukraine, have tried to essentially group the two together. So you can understand why actually Ukraine is now finding it quite difficult to perhaps use the same sort of language about the Second World War that their cousins in Russia have been using.
Totally understandable. And also totally understandable, I think, if you are... a Ukrainian politician, your country has been invaded by your neighbor. You're trying to get in bed with the power, that the only power around which may be able to help you, and that is the European Union. I mean, that's from a European perspective a rather good thing. Historically, of course, it's fascinating because you have to remember that a lot of Ukrainians had been murdered. You could call it a genocide if you wanted to in the 30s through the Soviet economic program under Stalin, which meant that initially when the Nazi army invaded, a lot of Ukrainians were actually quite helpful, very happy, and helpful, and fought on the Nazi side against the Russians. And only later, and of course there were also a large number of Ukrainians fighting on the Soviet side, but there are all sorts of very interesting historic implications to this.
Oscar, when we look forward to May the 8th, victory in Europe Day, there are going to be a lot of potentially quite interesting side meetings going on, or they would if they had all actually agreed to come to the same commemorations.
Yeah, but the problem there is that we're as we're living the era of ideological prosopopeia, we're also witnessing a lot of historical revisionism. There are a lot of people very busy trying to rewrite the history of the 20th century in order to justify today's antagonisms. We should distinguish between today's antagonisms and the fact that back then, in the 1930s, World War II was an anti-fascist struggle, and an anti-fascist struggle in which the then Soviet Union, which included Ukraine and Russia, and Europe fought together with America.
Okay, staying on the Russian topic even, Vladimir Putin's diplomatic circle has been looking perhaps slightly sparse lately as world leaders increasingly turn their backs on the Russian leader. But not everyone is refusing to tick the RSVP box. Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner is in Moscow this week, and she's wasted no time making her sales pitch clear, with oil, gas and food investment taking stage. Ms. Fernandez de Kirchner isn't shying away from putting Argentina's ties with Russia at the forefront. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, this is one hopes for her sake that her trip to Moscow is perhaps less of a PR disaster than her trip to Beijing, where she managed to slightly offend Xi Jinping by sending out a tweet which perhaps sort of mocked the way Chinese people speak. They still seem to get some business out of the trip, but still. Do you think that she's going to have a better time of it in Russia?
One has to hope that she has learned the lesson. But there are important issues here. For instance, Argentina and Russia do not see eye to eye when it comes to the international legal doctrine that they accept. Argentina, when it comes to the Falklands, or what they call Las Malvinas, goes for the doctrine of territorial integrity, obviously, whereas the Russians are going for the doctrine according to which a referendum by a people matters most. What Kirchner has been pointing out is that there may be some double standards here. You cannot have the same doctrine being useful for the Falklands, but unuseful in Crimea. So she may have a point there. But of course, her concern here is to get money. Argentina needs investment. It doesn't have many investors, as we all know. So she'll be ready to cozy up to Moscow if need be in order to get that investment.
Sebastian, should anyone in the West worry if Argentina are making friends with Russia and China, or should they be quite relaxed and think, well, you know what, if you want to go that way, fine?
She got business in China. I can't for the life of me see how Russia could afford to, you know, prop up Argentina in a way that would actually help the president back home. The same, of course, was tried recently by the Greek prime minister on a visit to Moscow. When I look at the data from the Russian economy, I have severe doubts as to how much leeway Mr. Putin has in throwing money at allies. That's basically what they're asking for, isn't it?
Yeah, but let us not forget your politics. I mean, the Greeks did get a discount on gas, which will matter economically. But they were also throwing a geopolitical
that is true.
Well, yeah, I mean, Greece has something to offer.
Exactly.
Greece can say, we're part of the European
Union.
We can elbow the other guys when it comes to sanctions.
Something similar may happen in Latin America insofar as there have been concerns about the United States trying to intervene once more in Latin America. So, as it was the case with Venezuela, to show that there may be an alliance with Russia serves the purpose
but
of fending off.
But here's the thing: for most Argentinians, they would far rather, would they not? And correct me if I'm wrong. Have a strong relationship with the European Union and the United States than Russia and China.
Oh, that's absolutely the case, which is why, one shouldn't make too much out of this. It is important to have, and this idea matters to people in Latin America, the idea of a multipolar world. And that's what Kirchner is saying. You know, we need a world in which not only U.S. and Europe call the shots. So, as far as insofar as that is the argument, it can be sold and it can be bought by the Argentinians. But we shouldn't.
And Sebastian,
and the Russian, I'm sure that it's good propaganda for Putin as well. You know,
Absolutely.
he demonstrates to his own people, look, I've got friends all over the place, in America and in Europe. I've got influence.
And Sebastian, just briefly, from a European perspective, does Europe often just see Latin America as, oh yeah, Latin America?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm afraid. I think that's still the case. I think people are waking up to the tremendous potential, particularly in Brazil. Argentina, I think, is being viewed as slightly sad case.
But when you look at every other continent, let's leave aside North America, but from a European perspective, I feel that Europeans have more in common with Latin Americans than probably any other continent. You're nodding, Oscar.
It beggars the mind. I mean, that is the case. But the problem, let's face it, this is a post-war problem. The problem is that Europe thought this was the US backyard. It's no longer the case.
There we are. We'll have to leave it. Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Sebastian Borger, thank you both for joining us on Midori House. The programme was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Hewin. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Daniel Giacopelli's here next. Then it's Andrew Tuck with The Urbanist at 1900 hours. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great day. Goodbye.